So I'm going to talk this evening about imperfections and about embracing imperfections. And the first thing I'll say is, in my understanding of the wisdom traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, all the others, the deep truth of life is that all of us are deeply lovable exactly as we are. That this is our birthright. We all deserve tremendous love, tremendous acceptance for who we are. We don't have to earn that at all. It's part of who we are, and it can't be taken away from us. You know, no matter how many mistakes I make, how much I screw up, it's always underneath all the mess I may have at the surface, is that lovable nature. We are made of love, and we are made for love. And it's really remarkable how much neurobiological research, I mean, you know, neurobiology can't tell us if we're made of love, but it certainly is verifying that in a powerful way that we're made for love, we're made for connection, that we find our greatest meaning in connection and intimacy. So that's the framing. And I'll say, been thinking a lot about perfection and imperfection. Perfectionism is really driven by shame. Perfectionism, in many ways, is a kind of a fierce binding with shame. And toxic shame is really, I think, it's very widespread in our culture, and it drives so much behavior. Toxic shame is the feeling that I am the lowest creature in existence, that I am not worthy of love, I'm not worthy of acceptance, and I'm not even deserving of being here, that there's something embarrassing or even disgusting about who I am that I need to hide from others. It's a core visceral feeling, a very powerful feeling. And understandably, people run from that feeling often. And unfortunately, it's very clear how this pattern, say the pattern of perfectionism, how it would get passed down from generation to generation. You know, it's easy to imagine, say, there's a parental figure who's driven by shame, who's very perfectionistic. And of course, they have a baby or an infant. Well, babies and infants are unpredictable, you know. And so that parent is going to be freaked out and triggered anytime the baby or infant makes them look bad. And so that side of the dynamic is very clear. But how does that land with the child? So what the child's experience is that child learns very, very quickly in that environment that if I behave the way that mommy wants, if I behave the way that, you know, is approved of, then I get love, appreciation. But if I start to deviate from that, you know, when mommy's triggered, she's not emotionally available. And the infant experiences that as abandonment, and abandonment equals death. You know, and so there's a mortal fear of, you know, if either I'm perfect or I'm in mortal fear. And part of what the infant learns also, and of course this is not cognitive, this is all felt, is that love is something I earn. Love is something that I have to, you know, I have to behave in a certain way to get love, which means that who I am is not lovable, you know. And so all these powerful messages land for the child and are taken in. And this forms the basis of shame, which very much can drive perfectionism. Perfectionism is brutal in many ways. It's really, you know, a person who's a perfectionist is running in fear. You know, I have to, you know, put vast amounts of energy into keeping up the image, all around, you know, making sure no one thinks that I'm a failure in any way, you know. And the fear is that as soon as I make a mistake, they're going to see that I'm not worthy, and then that's going to be something that would destroy me, you know. And so it's almost this running in mortal fear. And so how do we work with that? How do we work from that place? I'll say certainly one useful technique is just simply working with affirmations. And affirmations are actually very powerful if they're used with discipline. You know, an affirmation just along the lines of, you know, I'm completely lovable and acceptable as I am. You know, saying something like that every day. And people don't get much out of affirmations because I think they don't use them with discipline. Like, you know, in other words, they say it for a little while, but then when it starts to bring something up and it gets difficult, then they put the affirmation aside. And spiritual work gets, any kind of spiritual work gets useful when we stick with it when it starts to get difficult, you know. I think I'll say that perfectionism in similar states are driven by, you know, how can I say, the way that that core shame works is it sends up verbal messages. Sends up messages along the lines of you are unworthy or no one will like you if you fail or, you know, whatever the nature of the verbal message is. And I often like to say that pain is the great advertising agency because the message of pain is loud, like advertising. It's frequently repeated, like advertising. And like advertising, it has little to no truth content, you know. But we live in such a head-centered, head-dominated, logical kind of culture, you know, with, you know, head has the arrogance of thinking, I know all the answers, I should be able to figure out everything, like that kind of thing. Head just gets completely bamboozled by the message of pain and swallows the message hook, line, and sinker. I think a metaphor that's very helpful for thinking about how to relate to pain, and I've used this metaphor before, but it's like a young child in temper tantrum. Often our own places of core pain were formed in infantile periods, and so they're very much like some kind of inner child or inner infant. If a one-year-old or two-year-old is in a temper tantrum, they're going to say all kinds of crazy things. You know, I hate mommy and daddy. I want mommy and daddy to go away. Like, you know, the whole you know, barrage of things that will come out of the infant's mouth. It would be a very dysfunctional parent who believed the child literally. You know, in fact, I mean, at best it would be dysfunctional, at worst it would be abusive, you know, to take the child at their word. What a wise parent will do is more or less completely discount whatever verbal content is coming out of the child's mouth and attend to the child's real needs. You know, the child is distressed, the child is emotionally dysregulated, and the wise parent attunes to that and addresses the real needs, pretty much ignoring the verbal content. And so the problem is that even if we would have the capacity to be the wise parent in the external world to an external child, toward our internal child, we're still the dysfunctional parent, you know. Too often, we're the ones believing, getting suckered by the verbal message rather than going beneath the verbal message to where the real need is. Any place that's holding a message of shame, you know, a message that, perfectionism is the only way, you know, that kind of thing, the real need is for forgiveness, self-forgiveness, self-understanding, self-acceptance, just self-allowing, allowing oneself to be however one is. You know, part of the healing from perfectionism or from any kind of shame-driven behavior is in controlled and safe ways, allowing oneself to be seen. You know, whether that's with a therapist, whether that's a trusted group of friends, you know, some kind of container where I know I'll be safe and I can say, you know, I made a mistake or, you know, I messed up here. And in a way that would, you know, more or less guarantee that one will be received compassionately. And then slowly the body starts to learn the message, oh, I can make mistakes and still be accepted, you know, which is, which can be a hard lesson for some of these core places of shame to internalize. Jung talked a lot about perfectionism, and he really contrasted perfection versus completion. You know, the head a lot of times constructs these ideals of perfection, and he talked about how dysfunctional they are. His way of saying it is that the psyche is profoundly compensatory. That it's always seeking a kind of equilibrium, and that each place in the psyche is, as it were, pointed toward wholeness. You know, and so if I'm trying to exclude part of my psyche, you know, that shame, I don't want to feel that, let me push that away, I'm trying to other it, I'm going to be giving it strength. And you know, if I other it enough, then it's probably going to come out in some other way. I'm going to be projecting it on other people. You know, those horrible people, they, you know, they have the problem, you know, like that kind of thing. You know, in a way, I'll probably be unconsciously creating the kinds of relationships or creating the kinds of situations that will trigger my pain. And it's precisely the way, how can I say, the pain itself is looking to get into the conversation. It's looking for a way to get ego's attention. And so unconsciously, I'll create those or, you know, I'll sniff out those kinds of relationships or those kinds of situations that actually trigger my shame. Because it's the psyche's way of bringing that part of the psyche into conversation with ego, you know. And so a lot of self-sabotaging is actually along these lines. You know, it's some deep part of us trying to get our attention. You might even say a dysfunctional bid for connection.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
So you mentioned the Jung, according to Jung, the psyche kind of points towards completeness, right?
Toward wholeness, yes.
Yeah. So it has a tendency to push out any imperfections. That's how I understood it.
Insofar as perfection is, I need to be only this way and not another way, the tendency toward completion would be against the tendency toward perfection.
Okay, so it's not tendency to embrace everything you are.
Completion is. Completion is about embracing everything you are. Perfection might be some very narrow ideal.
So according to Jung, the psyche has a tendency to embrace everything you are.
Yes.
Okay, so there's nothing to fight. I mean, the psyche...
In a way, yes. I mean, that's kind of what Buddhism is getting at. Yeah, there's nothing to fight once we get out of our own way, yeah. And it, how can I say? I mean, it is true that everything's pointed toward wholeness, but some of the young places are dysfunctional and need to grow up, and they can do that with love and acceptance, that sort of thing.
So So the self-sabotage is basically psyche trying to embrace the complete.
It's one part of the psyche trying to get the attention of the ego, yeah.
That's the completeness.
Yeah. Yeah, Jung actually, he even talked about the image. He said one way to think about the image of Christ crucified is a person who pursued perfection so pointedly, so vividly, that they were crucified by their own perfectionism. And meanwhile, the Buddha or the resurrected Christ, those are more images of completion, of wholeness. So I want to close with a poem. This is a poem, it requires a little bit of context. It's a poem by David White, and he was hiking in the Himalayas in a village called Braga. And he describes, you know, they went to a temple where there's this apparently a famous statue of the Buddha. And so they go into the temple and it's dark, and you know, there's whole process of the monk starting to light, you know, the yak butter candles, and you know, and slowly their eyes adjust and they see the Buddha. But then at a certain point it becomes bright enough and their eyes adjust enough that they see what's above the Buddha. And what's above the Buddha are all these carved faces of bodhisattvas. And apparently it was just a masterful job that the carvers did, because every single face was full of tremendous warmth, and it was conveying warmth and love and acceptance. And David talked about, you know, the moment when the group suddenly became aware of all these faces, it was like this wave of emotion went through the crowd, you know, that, you know, the way that all of us, we just kind of relax and open a bit when we're in the presence of profound acceptance. And David was really struck by the paradox. You know, here these incredibly radiant, loving faces. They're made of solid wood, you know. And meanwhile, we have these nice, fleshy, warm faces. But so often our faces are far less than loving and accepting, you know. And, you know, and even when we look at ourselves in the mirror, we're not very loving and accepting, you know. So I'll read this, and then I'll pass out the quote sheet. So this is the last part of the poem. If only our own faces would allow the invisible carver's hand to bring the deep grain of love to the surface. If only we knew, as the carver knew, how the flaws in the wood led his searching chisel to the very core, we would smile too, and would not need faces immobilized by fear and the weight of things undone. When we fight with our failings, we ignore the entrance to the shrine itself and wrestle with the guardian, fierce figure on the side of good. And as we fight, our eyes are hooded with grief and our mouths dry with pain. If only we could give ourselves to the blows of the carver's hands, the lines in our faces would be the trace lines of rivers, feeding the sea where voices meet, praising the features of the mountains and the cloud and the sky. Our faces would fall away until we, growing younger toward death every day, would gather all our flaws in celebration to merge with them perfectly, impossibly, wedded to our essence, full of silence from the carver's hands. So I'll share the quote sheet first with the zoomies, and then with the roomies.
Thank you.
Pages are sticking together here. There you go. So I put the David White poem there that, so you can read. Of course, a very famous quote from Rumi. Out beyond ideas of right wrongdoing and right doing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. And just this wonderful wonderful image of getting far beyond any idea of right and wrong. From Hazrat Inayat Khan, God breaks the heart again and again and again until it stays open. R.H. Blythe says, perfect does not mean perfect actions in a perfect world, but appropriate actions in an imperfect world. Hugh Prather says, perfectionism is a slow death. If everything were just like I would want it to be, just like I would plan for it to, then I would never experience anything new. My life would be an endless repetition of stale successes. When I make a mistake, I experience something unexpected. Daphne Rose Kingma said, if you have trouble loving yourself, imagine everyone in the world is a hungry soul whose life has been imperfect. Like you, they had imperfect parents. Like you, tragedies and difficulties befell them. If you could hear each person's story, you probably would be moved to tears and would want to reach out and embrace that person. You'd want to tell them that in spite of everything they've gone through, they have great value. From Tara Brock, there's something wonderfully bold and liberating about saying yes to our entire imperfect and messy life. Love that. Brian Stevenson says, I guess I've known but never fully considered that being broken is what makes us human. We all have our reasons. Sometimes we're fractured by the choices we make. Sometimes we're shattered by things we never would have chosen. But our brokenness is also the source of our common humanity, the basis of our shared search for comfort, meaning, and healing. Our shared vulnerability and imperfection nourishes and sustains our capacity for compassion. Two from Brené Brown, who, among other things, wrote a book called The Gift of Imperfection. Brené Brown said, authenticity is the daily practice of letting go who we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we are. And she also said, perfectionism is not a way to avoid shame. Perfectionism is a form of shame. Kristen Neff, who has studied self-compassion extensively, said, as I've defined it in my academic writing, self-compassion involves three components: being kind and caring toward yourself rather than harshly self-critical, framing imperfections in terms of shared human experience, and seeing things clearly without ignoring or exaggerating problems. Daniel Kupke says, despite what you may believe, you can disappoint people and still be good enough. You can make mistakes and still be capable and talented. You can let people down and still be worthwhile and deserving of love. Everyone has disappointed someone they care about. Everyone messes up, lets people down, makes mistakes. Not because we're inadequate or fundamentally inept, but because we're imperfect and fundamentally human. Expecting anything different is setting yourself up for failure. Rafsan al-Musafar said, beneath every perfectionist mind, there lives a poor soul dying of anguish and tired of fighting against the atrocious desire for making everything flawless. Izzy Victoria Odeis said, don't aim for perfection. Aim for better than yesterday. David Tien says, there's scientific evidence for the satisfier over the maximizer. Those who just get it done will generally be happier with the outcome and will be able to be more effective than those who try to maximize every decision and hold it off until they have a maximal amount of information. They are less happy with the outcome, whatever the decision they end up making, and that decision is only marginally optimal in most cases, and sometimes even worse. So get into the habit of being decisive. It is going to make you effective and happier. This is responding to the idea that perfectionists are often procrastinators. They're waiting until everything's perfect. And finally, Curtis Tyrone Jones says, people often miss out on their own human genius because they're trying to be more perfect than the gods.